The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
10 minutes after 7, hold the calls here because I have a call from Jeremy Kahn right now. He's the author of Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. Now, Jeremy, this is really you. It's not an artificial bot that's talking to me, right? Welcome to the show.
No, it's really me.
Okay, good. Because, in fact, half the time I'm starting to figure out that you know when we're talking to real people because there are the little hesitations and things like that that make sense. When someone sounds too perfect, I'm thinking that's a bot. Have you gotten to that point these days when you hear audio and people talking?
Yeah, but I actually think we need to be careful because actually the fake audio is getting so good that it even has these little pauses and uhs and stutters and things. And so it's becoming less true that you can tell just by some of these little verbal tics.
Okay. Now, you are an award-winning journalist for Fortune magazine, and you cover artificial intelligence. So this is your wheelhouse, really. Here's the challenge that I have with artificial intelligence. I get, and maybe I've watched too many science fiction movies. So talk me down off the ledge if I'm okay. Or not, all right? That I swear that everything that we're doing right now in our entire online world is doing nothing but training the replacement or the elimination of humanity in some... Is that a reasonable concern to you?
I think that's a bit inflated, that fear.
A bit inflated,
not
okay.
A bit inflated. I don't think we have to all worry that we're all going to lose our jobs. I don't think we have to worry that technology is going to somehow become sentient and kill us all. Some of these sci-fi scenarios, I think we do not have to worry about. I think the technology actually can do a lot of really good things for us. There are some risks, but I don't think it's the risk that we're all going to lose our job or that, the technology is somehow going to replace people completely as a species.
Okay, so you had mentioned that we're not all going to lose our jobs, right? Well, we got quite a few billion people on the planet here. And I can't help but think, though, that many of the lower-order jobs will be replaced with nothing other than universal basic income to keep these people alive. Is that a fair assessment over time?
I think there is some risk that some people will lose jobs in certain areas, but I actually think the technology, and this has been the trend with all previous technology, and I do not think there's a reason to think that this is going to be particularly different. There have been more jobs created net over time than have been lost through every previous technology, and I think we're going to see the same thing with AI. Yes, some people, for instance, one of the areas where it's coming on really strong right now is customer service support, call handlers, that kind of thing, where they are now almost all being assisted by AI systems, and it may be possible in the future that those jobs, you'll need a lot fewer human contact handlers for sure. I still think you're going to need some because there's going to be certain inquiries that just cannot be handled by the AI system. You're still going to need a few people to handle those. But a lot of those people may find that they don't have jobs anymore, but they're going to, I think, move on to other things and other areas where we will have jobs. And I think this technology actually, because it will supercharge economic growth in a lot of ways, and actually it'll allow some certain people who currently do not have enough either education or experience to perform certain higher order roles. For instance, you might see more people go into accounting without having a 4-year accounting degree, without having to be a CPA. They might be able to take on work that right now is reserved for people who have those qualifications, but now somebody with maybe just a 2-year associate's degree can do that work assisted by an AI co-pilot. That's going to create new opportunities for people. And actually, I think there is, if we get this right, the potential to reverse some of the income inequality that we've seen in the U.S. over the last several decades.
You know something, Jeremy? That is something I hadn't concerned, because I'm glad you brought up accounting, because my niece just graduated, 4-year degree, super, super smart, accounting, right? You know, she just did this.
Yeah.
And the thought that big brain could then be, in other words, the high-level people may have more to worry about because she could then be replaced by a smaller brain person who's using AI. Is that a possibility?
I think that's true. And I think for people in professions, there'll be this squeeze if you're kind of in the middle. I think the very top performers in any profession are going to be fine. In fact, they're going to be more valuable than ever. because they're probably going to have skills that are not easily replicable in any way by an AI system, or they're going to be, particularly people who do think anything that involves in-person work, and that includes like lawyers who have to go to court to appear. You know, we're not going to have robots in court anytime that soon. So again, those jobs, you know, are probably secure and safe. And if you're, and also a lot of the human relationships that are very important in jobs, you know, if you're a top salesperson in business and it's all relationship business, those relationships are not going to get replaced by AI. But a lot of the lower level functioning, and I think it's more the people in the middle that have something to fear, because yes, it is possible that you might have a less qualified person who can be assisted with AI to do kind of a mediocre job at most things. And then you might have kind of the squeeze where those people actually see it harder to earn a living, the current people in those professions, unless they're really talented. And if they're really talented, they're probably fine.
Is there a possibility, Jeremy, and by the way, I'm speaking with Jeremy Kahn, an excellent book. You've got to check this out. Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. Is there a possibility that humanity could dumb itself down, or a good percentage of it, by no longer feeling the need to learn as much or store as much knowledge, depending on AI for filling in the gaps in intelligence?
I think that is a danger, and it's one of the ones I really highlight in the book. It's one that I think doesn't get enough attention, is actually this technology works decently well, and there's going to be this, we tend to be kind of lazy as people, and I think there'll be this tendency to kind of outsource a lot of our important thinking and the hard work of thinking to AI, and that we'll kind of get de-skilled. We'll lose some of our critical thinking abilities, some of our real critical reasoning abilities. I think there's this dangerous idea inherent in this technology that somehow writing and thinking are separate activities completely, and you can just give the AI system some bullet points and let it do the writing for you. Mm. But actually, it's through writing very often that we refine our thinking, that we find holes in our reasoning and figure out ways to close those. So I think, you know, we shouldn't do this. We should be really cautious to when we use this technology to avoid this tendency to kind of outsource really important thinking to the bot, as it were.
And how will that work with education, in your view, given there's so much of it already with AI?
Yeah, so I think education, though, is one of these areas where there was a lot of fear from teachers when, like, ChatGPT came out 2 years ago. Oh, it's going to destroy education because students are just going to use it to cheat. And yes, students are going to get lazy. They're not going to do the work. But I think with some sensible changes to the curriculum, actually, this technology can have a tremendous positive effect on education. It can really put a kind of personal tutor in every student's pocket. And what you do is you have these systems, again, they have to, not just using kind of a general chatbot, but one that's really been fine-tuned, designed specifically to be a tutor. And what there are already some systems out there. Khan Academy, for instance, has no relation to me, but Sal Khan and his company, Khan Academy, has this tutor called Khanmigo out there.
Big
that
deal.
A lot of
yeah.
Started to use. Yeah. And that's designed to use kind of Socratic method. So it asks the students a bunch of questions that will lead the student to think of the right answer, but it will not give the student the answer. And I think, you know, there's other systems out there similarly being designed to act as tutors. And that's kind of the key, is to do that, to have a system that will lead the student towards the right answer, maybe work on it, will know what areas where the student's weak, where they're strong, will help the teacher actually have better interventions with the student. I think there's tremendous potential here in education to use the technology for good. And I think if teachers are smart about asking the student a couple probing questions, it becomes very clear if the student actually knows the answer or not, or has done the work. You know, if the student turns on a paper and then can't answer any, you know, simple questions about what's in it, there's a good chance the student didn't write the paper. And I think it's pretty easy for teachers to tell in that case. But I think, you know, if we take some simple steps like that to kind of crack down on cheating, then I think there's great potential to use the technology to be a personal tutor and to really help students.
All right. I'm going to have to read more on this, because I'm going to have you back. I'm going to find you and have you back on the show here for sure. Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. Very thought-provoking. Jeremy Kahn, thanks for a few minutes, and we'll have you back. Take care.
Thanks so much.
19 after 7. This is the Bill Myers Show. KMED and 99.3 KBXG.
Of the Bill Myers Show is proudly sponsored by Phoenix Auto Center Tire Pros and Full Service Auto.
Big Lou's like you. He's on meds too. For affordable term life insurance, call 800-TERM-LIFE. That's 800-TERM-LIFE.
The Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Yeah, every time I hear those Big Lou ads, I always have this picture in my mind of who Big Lou must be. Like a 350-pound guy on his mobility scooter with the trophy wife on his right arm. Anyway, of course, it could be those other fake internet ads. How many times do you see the fake internet ads? They're obviously fake, in which you see they show the picture of, hey, the secret to building muscle after 60. So they got the gray hair guide, and it's obviously photoshopped onto about a 25-year-old dude with a 12-pack, you know? You just get so tired of it. Same with women, too. They do the same thing with women. They take the, you know, the 60-year-old head, and they splice it onto the hot body. Hey, just take this pill. And now we have artificial intelligence to imagine the fakeness or non-fakeness of the world here. And we have not-so-crazy Gene to comment on that, because I had an artificial intelligence conversation with Jeremy Kahn a few minutes ago. He's written a book about it, and I'd like to find out more about it and get him back on the show. I only had 9 minutes. So what are you thinking about that, Gene? Welcome.
Well, I'm just wondering if we ourselves are not artificial intelligence created by somebody else that already come up with that idea.
Okay, so we're the artificial intelligence, you're saying? Is that it?
Yeah, an artificial intelligent robot. We do have arms and legs.
Uh-huh.
But what makes us think that human life is what we call human life? I mean, it's all a concept of our own imagination.
Well, I would dare say, though, that it is the concept of spirit, which cannot be created in the lab or on the factory assembly line. What about that?
Our lab, but there could be other labs that have more articles in them.
Oh, now you're folding my brain over. If you're thinking that human consciousness, the actual consciousness, the soul aspect, could be manufactured. All right.
That means we don't really understand this stuff. Of course it could be manufactured by somebody that does understand.
Okay. I don't know if I want to go there, but... because it makes me uncomfortable. It would make me question my worldview. But thank you for that, okay? Jeez. Oh, no. Could my soul have been manufactured by a space alien? All right, let me go to Lauren. Hello, Lauren. You wanted to talk about the stolen valor thing. Of course, you're a Marine, right? You're retired
sir.
Marine.
I was out walking earlier whenever you were talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never tell you about a struggle I've had in that regard.
Sure.
I was in the Marine Corps Reserve for 6.5 years. I was walking out of the local out of Sherm's one day, and the guy said to me, "Hey, have you ever been to?" I wear a hat. Always says, "Once a Marine, always a Marine," because I'm proud of the time I did. But I did no overseas service. It was all at home.
Oh,
all
what?
Reservists.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I was invited to go to the to Washington D.C. for the honor flight. And I said,
"Oh, yeah. By the way, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. You had now you went to that, didn't you? Right?
Yes, I did, but I felt guilty.
Oh,
I felt guilty because I hadn't been in Nam, in Vietnam. My brother had been there, but I'd never been there. But I did 6.5 years. I got out, and 6 months later, my unit was sent to Vietnam, which I thanked the Lord for. But I had already become a pastor by that time, going to college to do that. But it's an interesting thing, but lying, I hate lying. And when I hear anybody, you know, just stretch the truth, and I would never say I'm a Vietnam vet. Matter of fact, they gave me a hat. I got it right up here on my door. Vietnam veteran. I will not wear that. I'm a Vietnam era veteran.
Okay. And so is that the take? That's the issue then you have with Tim Walz, implying that he was a Operation Enduring Freedom veteran mm-hmm. when he yeah. was in the military at that time. So it's that era
right.
thing once again.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And so I'm proud to do that, and I'm thankful to save my country, to serve my country. But at the same time, I'm not telling anybody ever that I was in Vietnam. My brother was there for 18 months, and that was enough for me.
Do you think this issue with Tim Walz will actually cause trouble, or is this much to do about nothing in today's America?
I think it'll make a difference to some guys, especially vets who did serve, who know that he's just blowing smoke.
Okay. All right. Appreciate the take on that, Lauren. Take care. 770-5633. Let me go to the next line on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Good morning. Hello. Hey, you're on. Okay. You gotta listen to the phone. Gotta listen to the phone. Hopefully this person will figure it out. Good morning. I'll give you one more shot. I'm sorry, I can't do that. I want to give you your take on the air. I really do. But you have to listen to the phone first. Okay, 729. We'll break for the rest of the news here. And maybe that caller will come back and have a great take on some issues. We'll have some more open phones on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Up next, though, the Conspiracy Theory Thursday of the rigged election. The rigged election of 2020. I thought that there's been enough evidence that there is certainly a preponderance of hinky in some locations, especially Georgia comes to mind. And there's some additional evidence out now that's saying that there was a problem in Georgia, enough to actually change the results of the election. But Ken Block is a data guy, and he worked for the Trump campaign, and he says it's not quite that simple and not as rigged as we think. And he had a debate with the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, about it, and they both agree and they want better elections. He's just taking a different take on it. So it's like, all right, I'll talk with him about it. Ken Block, good guy, and we'll kick it around at about 5.
Getting ready for a summer road trip?
Hi, I'm Deb with Father and Son Jewelry, and I'm on KMED.
Ken Block's a technology entrepreneur, advocate for good government. And boy, we could use more of that. And also the founder of a centrist political party, too. Hey, by the way, Ken, what party did you found? I'd like to hear more about that. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, so, well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and good morning. So I live in a deeply blue state, Rhode Island, and it was really, we have single-party governance across the board. Out of 113 members of the legislature, the Republicans usually have 10 or 11.
Wow, that makes Oregon look pretty good by comparison, because we're pretty much in that same role, really.
Yeah, so I grew increasingly frustrated in 2007, 8, 9. My tax burden was outrageous, and here on the East Coast, people used to refer to Massachusetts as Taxachusetts, and I was paying more taxes in Rhode Island than I would have had I lived a mile across the border in Massachusetts. So I started a new political party that was just focused on economic issues, quality of life stuff, and tried to leave everything else off the table. Called it, unfortunately, the Moderate Party.
Oh,
which I caught a lot of grief for. it was interesting and very difficult to pull it off. We had to sue the state and federal court to even get the chance to create the party. We got some laws declared unconstitutional and survived all the challenges. Built the party. And it was only after I did all that I realized that people just don't get it. At the time, people didn't equated third parties with crazy, and it was hard to build any momentum.
Yeah, not that there's ever any crazy in the two-party system. It's perfectly sane at all times. Just watch the news. It's okay. Now, Ken, in all seriousness, though, you have you are a data guy, right? And so you are into voter data, voter analytics, and you've driven legal action. You also helped Texas, from what I understand, save over $1 billion in food stamp fraud and problems. And you can find out more at kenblock.com. But more importantly, you put out a book, though, about the election of 2020, which to me has looked a little hinky in certain spots here. But you wrote a book about this, and I know you debated Mike Lindell on these issues, and I wanted to talk with you about this. It's called Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the Data That Shows Why He Lost and How He Can Improve Our Elections. And this has to do with, and once again, you were working for the Trump campaign during that question time of 2020, right? Could you break down a little bit of what's going on here?
Sure. I, out of the blue, got a phone call from one of the top attorneys in the Trump campaign apparatus. His name was Alex Cannon. And he very directly asked me to help the campaign look for voter fraud in the swing states. This was the day after the election in 2020. I kind of couldn't believe that had just happened, especially since I wasn't shopping my services around for that. Decided to help out, and we were brought on board to look for evidence of dead voters voting by mail in the election, people who voted twice in the election. And as Alex and I got to know each other very, very quickly over the course of a day or two, he fully trusted my company's ability to do this work, and he asked us to start vetting the claims of voter fraud that were coming in from all over the country to help him understand which of those claims, if any, could be used to successfully launch a lawsuit contesting the election results in any of the swing states. And of all the work that we did for the Trump campaign in that time period, that was the work, in my opinion, that was most important. And we went through about 20 different claims of voter fraud, and we were able to show the campaign exactly why each of them was wrong. And as a result of that work, the campaign did not launch some lawsuits that they were considering launching. And Cannon communicated to Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff at the time, that the campaign looked exhaustively at the claims of fraud, looked for evidence of enough dead people voting to matter. And the short answer was could not find anything that came close to altering the outcome of any of the elections.
Okay. That's interesting. Now, does this include all the claims? Were you involved with all the big claims? Like, remember, was it in Georgia where they ended up stopping the count in the middle of the night and they told everybody to go home, but they did continue to keep counting? Did you look into those claims, including the so-called suitcases of votes that were underneath the table that kept run up and they were run multiple times? Were you involved in that, in those claims, or not?
No. So the claims we were involved with were the claims that involved election data.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Oh, kind of like Dominion, kind of like the Dominion issue. Is that what we're speaking about?
No, more so. So the claims that were brought to my attention that they asked us to vet were claims like 750,000 duplicate votes were cast in Wisconsin. That was a real claim that was made.
Oh.
That we were able to show was false. In Pennsylvania, some academics brought forward a theory that a mathematical theorem that is often used to identify fraudulent transactions on Wall Street, for example, was applied to election data in Pennsylvania, and they reached the conclusion that there was massive fraud in Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania's voter data, when they applied this theorem to it, failed completely. And mm-hmm. I was able to show why what they did was a bad analysis, basically. So I was very much deep down in the technical weeds, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Dealing with data. And, you know, the problem with so many claims that didn't cross my desk were a lot of them were hearsay claims. And what I mean by that is those were claims that, you know, someone talked about a tractor trailer full of ballots going somewhere, or
oh yeah,
someone
I remember
saw
that
a bunch
one
of ballots in a ditch, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
and those aren't the kinds of claims that any court of law is going to allow, right? Unless you actually have the evidence of that truck and the ballots that were in it, the claim can't go anywhere, right? And so even though
that could have happened, it doesn't rise to the level. You better have big proof if you're going to make a big claim that 100,000 votes or whatever it is were on that truck, right? That kind of thing.
Right. And, you know, and what it comes down to is we don't convict people in this country solely on the basis of circumstantial evidence, right?
Mm.
Yeah, and the ask, the legal ask, and why the work that I did was so important and why the campaign asked me to do it in the first place was because the ask that they wanted to make was huge, maybe one of the biggest legal asks ever made, which was to overturn the results of an election, right? So you better come with ironclad 100% proof that what you're claiming happened. And every time that legal standard was applied to whatever the claims were, the claims came up short.
So it's not that we don't necessarily think that there was a problem, but it doesn't rise to the court of law standard. Is that to understand it correctly, Ken? I just want to understand because there was so much that just seemed to smell bad about various places and mostly in the swing states, and that I couldn't help but my little spidey sense going, this doesn't look right. And sometimes things can not look right and still be okay.
Right. So look, there's plenty that we can and should change about the way we conduct our elections.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have far better election integrity than we do right now. The problem is to get there requires some changes that a lot of folks who think conservatively may not really like, right? So, for example, the biggest election integrity issues we have are people who are registered to vote in multiple different places across the country, because when they move, their old registration doesn't disappear, right?
And in a vote-by-mail situation, a lot of times they still get sent ballots, right?
And sometimes they vote twice, but we didn't see huge evidence of that in 2020. We found some, but, you know, hundreds, not thousands, and certainly not tens of thousands. But to fix that problem and to fix the issue where some states maintain their data well and do a good job at it, and some states do an absolutely terrible job at it, to even that all out and get it done professionally and solve the problem of multiple registrations, you really, speaking about it strictly technically, you really should have a federal voter registration. One place. Now you don't have duplicate registrations. Now you can ensure that dead people get removed from the rolls the same way every time, right? But, you know, conservatives don't necessarily like federalizing anything, and I get that.
Yeah, I understand that. But in this case, I can see the appeal if the problem is that we have, you know, multiple states with multiple problems and multiple systems, too, by the way. It would appear to be the only, you know, the true only fix for some of the issues.
Speaking about it strictly as a technologist, it's the only reasonable way to fix the crazy way we conduct our elections right now.
Hmm. I'm talking once again with Ken Block. His book is Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, The Data That Shows Why He Lost and How We Can Improve Our Elections. Well, we talked a bit about how to improve the elections, and I concur with you that a centralized database for this particular purpose would seem to work pretty well. Now then, as to why he lost, why you think he lost, according to the data that you were diving into for all this time, my gut always told me that it was losing part of the white vote. But I just, I don't know if that's true or not, because I'm not one of these data kind of guys. What say you?
So I'm going to give you data from three different places. One is my data. One is data out of Georgia from the Secretary of State's office, and one is data from Trump's own pollster. And my data shows that when you look at Trump's performance in 2020 versus 2016, he did almost uniformly across the country about 2.5% less well. His share of the vote was down about 2.5% everywhere relative to his Democratic opponent. In the country, red states, red counties, blue counties, no matter how you diced it up, it was somewhere between a 2 and 2.5% decline. And when you dive into the reddest counties in Georgia, that decline was still there. And what I believe that is, and what Raffensperger and Trump's pollster confirm in their own research, is those were moderate Republicans. And Trump lost their support. In fact, to a large extent, he told them not to support him.
To an extent, in other words, it was the never Trump, but it was essentially the never Trump thing, right? The never Trumper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what Trump calls rhinos, right? Conservatively minded, maybe if they're fiscal conservatives, but not necessarily social conservatives, whatever. Right. He didn't, their support was lost, and Trump's pollster, Fabrizio, who, by the way, pulled my campaign in 2014 here in Rhode Island. I ran for governor as a Republican, and I always disclose that because I can't really talk about him without disclosing that.
Yeah.
He did a 30,000-person exit poll in the swing states directly after the election. And what he found and published, which was supposed to be an internal document, but it leaked, was that 1 out of 6 of the 30,000 people they polled were Republicans who abandoned Trump. 1 out of 6. That's a big percentage, and that's not a statistical error, right? That's a big finding. And another 1 out of 6 of the 30,000 were first-time voters motivated to vote primarily against Trump, right? So in 2016, Trump motivated a ton of brand-new voters to vote for him. And in 2020, it was the opposite thing happening, where new voters were coming in and generally voting against him.
Hmm. I often wondered if there was a bit of the chaos of 2020 that maybe drove some of that less enthusiasm. What you were bringing up there, right?
I, I don't think I'm wrong when I say that had COVID not happened, I'm pretty sure Trump would still be president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a feeling that may be something. I think that he is looking at looking at the campaign this year between, you know, Harris and Walz and Trump. I would definitely say there's a different tone this year, different tone than I would say in 2020. It's not quite as defensive. We'll see how that ends up working. But I think that's reasonable on some of the numbers there. However, what is really interesting, though, and I know this news just broke, so you probably didn't get a chance to check this out, and I would love to get your take on it at some point, that in Georgia, because you were talking about Georgia being a one of these things, Georgia State Election Board was talking over SEP 2023 to 025 yesterday morning, and what they were finding out is that there may have been some actual problems there that could have changed that. I don't know if that would have been enough to have changed the presidential election. But the story goes that there were about 18,000 votes counted with no ballot images and 20,000 original votes from the tabulators that came out of thin air, apparently, is what the claim is. And about 4,000 duplicates counted and inserted through some kind of human intervention. And if there ends up being something with that, I guess they're talking about that in Georgia, would something like that have been enough to flip it? What was the margin of victory in Georgia? Do you happen to recall, Ken?
So, yeah, and that's a great question, and I have a two-part answer for you. The margin of victory was just under 12,000 votes.
12,000. So that's not very many. Yeah.
That's not very many. So you are talking about the numbers that you ran past me, and I just up front, I haven't had a chance to dive in and get into any of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I promise you I will, and if you want to catch up on it again at some future date, I'm happy to do it. Here's the thing with voter fraud in general. Now, we didn't find 10,000 fraudulent votes in Georgia in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
We found maybe 100. But let's imagine that we did find 12,000 fraudulent votes. We didn't, but let's imagine that we did. What the campaign and what I could never document and never state with any certainty was that those votes harmed one candidate and benefited another candidate. Because when we vote anonymously. You don't know for whom a specific person cast a vote. So you can't show, legally speaking, you can't prove that you were harmed by the fact that there was a bunch of voter fraud that was documented and confirmed. And honestly, for the voter fraud I found over the decade I've been looking at this, and I've probably found 10,000 different cases of voter fraud over the years spread out across almost every state, it's pretty evenly divided who commits those frauds, right? It's a bipartisan activity.
Oh, I would agree. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised in Texas you find Republicans doing the voter fraud, doing the hinky. Right. You know, try to.
Yeah. So, you know, so unless they actually have the specific ballots that they're talking about and can prove for whom each of those ballots was cast, you still can't make an argument that therefore the election result was wrong.
Mm.
Right. And to me, it's extraordinary that we're still relitigating 2020, and 2024 is right on top of it.
Oh,
right?
I know. Well, let me ask you this, Ken. Let's say with what they're talking about out of Georgia right now, if we have, essentially 40,000-50,000 votes that are questionable in a state that had a 12,000 vote winning margin for the Biden campaign, and the 50,000 questionable came out of Atlanta, you know, kind of, or the, you know, the blue sections of Atlanta, which is, you know, predominantly that way. That could have been something if we had known that at the time, right? That would have been something actionable because that arguably would have helped Biden and hurt Trump. Is that a fair assessment to think about it that way?
Underline the word arguably because there are still probably more than 40,000 Republican registered voters in that district that you're talking about. So it's still, speaking about it strictly legally, you really can't, you haven't crossed all your legal T's and dotted your I's making a claim where someone in the legal system looks at that and says, yeah, this election clearly had the wrong result, right? Now, as I understand, I quickly Googled it between the time we said hello and when we were here.
I don't know if you found that, but thanks anyway. I just want to let you know because that just came in my box last night. You know, I just got it. I was thinking, wow.
But what I quickly found out about it is an election board, a state election board, which just ideologically changed, decided to reopen an investigation of these claims which had been made prior.
Mm-hmm. These were prior claims then. Okay.
Yeah. And so they're re-litigating these claims from before. So that's what I seem to understand based on what I just read. So I don't think it's new ground. I think they're just revisiting old ground.
All right. Very good. Well, I wanted to ask, I wanted to make sure you knew about that because otherwise people are going to say, what, you didn't ask them?
No problem.
All right.
It's hard to stay on top of everything.
Oh, I know. And let me tell you, the news changes. It's like drinking from a fire hose all the time when it comes to the news this year, for sure. Ken, what do you think then? You had talked about that definitely a centralized one voter database. I agree. This is one example that I think would make so much sense. And I know that conservatives will tend to resist this, but this is an example of where the federal, having one database to work from, would be best. I really do agree with you. And that takes care of a lot of the issues. The other thing that I would think, though, is what about the concept? Everything is about this anonymized. Oh, gosh, it has to be a secret vote, et cetera, et cetera. What would you think about a hash of some sort connected with every ballot so that it doesn't say it's your name on it, but you know it's yours and you could actually examine it and see how it was tabulated after the fact? Would you be okay with something like that too, with like
a
hash?
What's interesting, I just read about this the other day. There's a lawsuit in Texas. Texas has this idea of a hash so that they can trace back the vote just for the reasons that you were describing.
And exactly.
Somebody claims to have broken the code and can tie individuals' votes back to the registered voter.
Mm.
And there's a lawsuit because the anonymity has been lost in Texas. That's what the claim is. That's what the legal claim is. So I think that there are many much more important reforms that we should get to first. I'm going to give you a quick example.
Okay.
If you cast a vote early, either in person or by mail, let's say 3 weeks before the election, and then you die before the election, does your vote count or does your vote not count?
Boy, what does the law say? I don't know. I never thought about that.
Well, it depends on where you live.
Oh, or died.
Or died, exactly. So in some states it counts, in other states it doesn't count. How can our federal elections, where you're voting for members of Congress or the president, how is it acceptable that whether a vote counts or doesn't count in this circumstance can be different from place to place, right? I mean, so we have developed and grown into a system of conducting our elections where states and sometimes different counties in the same state do the same thing really differently. And another example of this is the country's most expensive voter data is in Alabama. If you want to look at Alabama's data, you have to pay the state $40,000 to do so. Well, California charges $25, Florida gives it to you for free, New York State gives it to you for free. When you talk about transparency in elections, how is it acceptable that pretty much nobody is looking at Alabama's data? Unless you have deep-pocketed sponsors behind you to purchase it. And Alabama is not actually the worst for the access to this data. Massachusetts won't give you the data under any circumstances, nor will New Hampshire, nor will Illinois, nor will Indiana. So there's a lot that is lacking in terms of consistency in how we conduct our elections. And I argue that those inconsistencies lead to many more problems than they solve. And we should really revamp our elections and we should modernize how we do it. We're doing things the way we did 200 years ago, But we don't have to do them that way anymore. 200 years ago, they had no choice. So these are the things that I think are most important. And by tightening up our election integrity, by dealing with the mishmash of inconsistencies in laws and rules and regulations between jurisdictions, I think we can end up with a far better voting environment than we have right now.
Which would also imply more greater public trust on this, too. I also, would you agree with me that there should be no such thing as early voting, and there should be election day, not election season, which is what we have right now? Isn't the fact mail-in voting, which is inherently, there's no chain of custody on something like that, it should be a non-starter. What do you think?
I think what's missing from, I don't think we can get rid, I don't like mail ballots personally, but I also don't think it's realistic to say that we're ever going to get rid of them. What we should have, though, is we should, if we do a federal voter registry, we should have a voter identification number that can be used to prove you are who you say you are, that gets attached to the mail ballots when they get sent in. Right? What's missing from the mail ballots is the hard identification of the voter in a way that we can have great confidence that whoever voted that ballot is who they say they are.
Agreed.
And if we did that, I think we solved the problem with mail ballots.
Ken, very interesting. And I'd like to have you back because there are a lot more to this at some point. But the book is Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections. I really appreciate the talk, and it kind of cuts against my preconceived notions and things, but I always appreciate that. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'll come on anytime you want.
All right. By the way, kenblock.com is your main website, too. Is that the right one? Okay. Thank you, Ken. It's 8 o'clock. This is KMED and KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass.